It is a ritual that has been practiced secretly for generations. An act so disturbing, it is performed only under the cloak of darkness. It is the horror feared all across America.
Matt the Cat!
Lord have mercy, baby! Welcome to another Friday Night Catfight Show. I'm your furry leader, Matt the Cat, where it's at. Doing the do just for you. And have I got a special program for you this week, cats and kittens. The legendary Lloyd Price joins me as you've never heard him before. Uncut, unadulterated, and delivering to you the truth about the birth of rock and roll and the history of rhythm and blues. Lloyd was there, and he's going to share it all with you in just a moment, baby. The entire program this week is dedicated to Mr. Lloyd Price, who has a brand new book out. We're going to talk about that in a moment. But first, I want to start the program off with a song that really shows Lloyd's diversity. It was written in 1954 by jazz pianist Errol Gardner, but in the early 60s, Lloyd made it his own. Backed by the super sharp and ultra-tight Lloyd Price Orchestra, here's the versatile Lloyd Price singing Misty.
Look at me. I'm as helpless as a kitten up a tree. Feel like I'm clinging to a cloud. I can't understand just holding your hand. Baby, walk my way. Feel like thousands of violins began to play. Or is it the sound of your hello, that music I hear every time you're near? You can say that you're leading me on, but that's just what I want you to do. Don't you notice how hopelessly I'm lost? Baby, that's why I'm following you. And baby, on my own, no, I'd never wander through this wonderland alone. Never knowing my right foot from my left, my hat from my glove, I'm too much in love. Yeah, baby, too misty. Oh, baby, I know you hear me, I'm too misty. Great Googa Mooga, I know you hear me talking. Too much, too much in love, 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 love.
The legendary Lloyd Price. I'm your host, Matt the Cat. Welcome to the Friday Night Cat Fight. I've got an exclusive extended interview with Mr. Personality himself, which will begin in just a moment. But first, I want to tell you about Lloyd's brand new book. It's called Lottie Miss Claudie, The True King of the 50s, The Music Authentic Historic Truth, The Lloyd Price Story. And it's written with the help of William Dollar Bill Waller. And if you're interested in learning more about this great new book from Lloyd Price, all you have to do is go back to my website, FridayNightCatFight.com, and click on the Lloyd Price banner. And this book covers Lloyd's life from his birth up to the late 1950s. And man, I'll tell you, Lloyd paints such a great picture of the decade, a truthful picture of the decade. This is how it really happened from a guy who was there. And nobody was bigger in the music industry in the early to mid-1950s than Lloyd Price. And many times history gets written by those who weren't even there. Lloyd was there, and he's going to tell us some amazing stories about how he cut one of the first rock and roll records, to how he organized one of the largest sporting events in history. And in between, we're going to touch on some of the greatest rock and roll and rhythm and blues icons of the 1950s and 60s. Plus, of course, I'm going to play some of Lloyd's greatest records. Now, if you've ever heard an interview with Lloyd or you've seen him on TV, he's always been a professional and caring individual that puts you at ease. And as an interviewer, I got to tell you, interviewing Lloyd Price was one of the highlights of my career. It felt like I was talking to an old friend, and I'm proud to be able to say that, well, I can call Lloyd my friend. Just to show you how at ease we were during this interview, I'm going to start the interview portion of this program by playing you a little bit of behind-the-scenes banter between Lloyd and I before we launch into it. This is Lloyd Price, the feature this week on the Friday Night Catfight.
I feel weird. I shouldn't have headphones on, Lloyd.
Oh, no?
No, because you're not wearing them. I'm going to try without. Well, thanks for coming in, Lloyd.
Well, it's my pleasure, Matt.
So many people have failed where you've succeeded, in the sense that you're a successful singer-songwriter, a businessman. I mean, you owned your couple of record labels, what, like three or four record labels?
Four.
Four record labels.
Right.
You owned your own club, The Turntable, in New York City.
Right.
And why do you think you've been so successful business-wise, whereas other people in your same situation have failed?
Well, actually, man, I don't know. Each time I had a hit record, I never looked at it as being something forever. I just saw it as a blessing. And I tried to make the best of that run. And I never saw myself as what they now call themselves superstars. I saw myself as an entertainer, always trying to do a good job for my public. And I tried to keep it moving. You know, I never thought nothing would last forever, because it doesn't. So I guess in terms of my publishing and stuff like that, when I came out of the service, I decided that I wanted to have a piece of that for myself, because while in the service, I learned how to do things a little different than when I was a kid with my first recordings. So I would credit that part of my life of a business person to the Army days. And I guess that's the thing that gave me such a wider vision.
What did you do when you were in the Army? What was your specialty?
Well, I was in special service.
Oh, okay.
I first went over as an infantryman, and then I later, when they discovered I was there, well, let me just tell you what happened. When I went into the service, they had never heard of this stuff that we call rock and roll or rhythm and blues. It was either race music or music. But when I went into service, I went into service because of the power of my music. My music had started to integrate America. And they was wondering what was that I was doing. Of course, Lord and Miss Claudia was my first record. I had heard of Japan, but I'd never heard of Korea and all that other business. So when I was drafted into the service, in order to kind of stop integrating the South, because all the kids wanted to come and hear me or see me. I didn't understand it. I was just a kid. But I found all these things out later, why I was drafted. The draft board even told me that I had to go into service because of the ruckus I was causing with my music. So when I got to Korea, the same thing happened. I was in a Lion Company near the 38th parallel. When the kids in the service found out that Lloyd Price was in that company, it was crazy. I didn't realize so many people had heard of me and had heard of my music. So they immediately took me out of the Lion Company and put me in special service to organize entertainment, to entertain the troops in Korea.
And you were at it again.
Yeah.
Entertaining again.
Exactly.
I can't believe that is why they, it's said that that's why Elvis was drafted, you know, because he was causing too much of a commotion at that time. But I can't believe that they actually did that to you and that you found out about it, that you know for a fact that that's the reason. I'm blown away by that.
Oh, yeah, the draft board, the lady at the draft board, she told me.
That's something,
she
man.
She said,
I can't
believe it. At that time you had Billboard in Mississippi You know, you had Bull Connors in Alabama. You had Russell Long in Louisiana. These was real bad guys.
Oh yeah.
You know, so they just didn't want to hear anything about kids mixing. And what could be more innocent than a bunch of kids, no matter who they are, dancing to music? It was a new beat. They discovered this new backbeat with this 6/8 shuffle. Mm-hmm. They had never done anything like that. Before that, you know, everything was the jitterbug or the pickle or one of those dances. Well, kids, before 1952 and before Billy Ward and the Dominoes had 60 Minute Man.
Which crossed over.
It crossed, yeah. Mm-hmm. This music was really for adults. Mm-hmm. And now that was no long time ago. It was adults music. The kids only danced when the parents wasn't home. We tried to learn how to dance because we had no music. There was nothing for kids.
Right.
So when I recorded Lord and Miss Claudia and slowed the music down where kids can kind of rock to it and came up with their own dances like they're doing today, well, that kind of like shook the nation up a mm-hmm. little bit. And that was like 4 years before Elvis.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody, I don't know if I heard this or if I read this, but somebody said that it was because, well, rock and roll gets a lot of credit, in their opinion, as being one of the driving forces behind the civil rights movement of the 60s.
Oh, no question.
Because black kids and white kids actually started integrating for the music. And then when it came time for civil rights, a lot of white people were right there to support the cause because whatever their parents were telling them was this way or that way, they didn't care anymore because they had seen the other side. I mean, when you're closed off and you hear black people are bad, what are you supposed to think, you know? But then all of a sudden, when you realize that's not the truth at all, everything's cool, then, you know what I mean? So when I heard that or read that, I thought that was amazing because imagine if rock and roll hadn't happened. Could the civil rights movement have happened?
Well, Matt, that's one of the paragraphs I have in my book. I absolutely have in my book because music was universal. The kids didn't care what color the music was. All they knew is that they loved the beat.
Right.
And it really, 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 before Martin Luther King or anybody sitting in anywhere, these kids wanted to dance to that music. You know, back then it was skating rings. They would do it in a skating ring wherever it was permitted or permissible. They would skate together on this music. They had the touch. They had the bump. They had the, you know, they had to see that people were people. And what harm could there be in dancing to the same beat? So the old guard didn't want that to happen. They did not want that to happen. And when Elvis came along, he added shaking his leg to it, even though it was out of rhythm, it was out of sync, but he did something different. And that's why they called it black music at the time. Why are you dancing to that black music? But I'd never seen music in any color. I always heard it, you know what I mean?
Right.
And that's the way the kids in this country heard it, and that's how they heard it around the world.
There are plenty of white guys that sing, you know, with soul, and there's plenty of black guys that actually sing pure pop.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? It's not necessarily a color thing.
No question.
That's on my Harlem show, I end the show by saying soul, it's not a black thing, it's not a white thing, it's a feeling. And if you got it, pass it on, you know, keep the soul going. But the Rumble in the Jungle, where was the seed planted for that? Because you were a big time part of that, organizing that whole thing. So back to the business, we were talking about business before. What was your involvement?
Well, the Rumble in the Jungle, Muhammad Ali, at that time Cassius Clay, was a real, real good friend of mine. And I had met him a few years before the Rumble in the Jungle because I had had, Stagger Lee, I'd had Misty, I'm Gonna Get Married, Just Because, Questions, Where Were You on My Wedding Day. I had 11 hits or something before the Rumble in the Jungle. And I also knew Don King. Don was a dear friend of mine, not was, still is. I've known Don practically half of my life. And Don was interested in doing something different when he got out of college. You know what I mean? He had this big nightclub. Well, he built the nightclub in Cleveland so that I could put my big band in his corner tavern. There was, you know, back during that time, there was little small clubs that you go in and play, seated 300 or 400 people. I always traveled with a big band because I wanted to give my audience the same sound they heard on records. I wanted to give them that in person. What you've seen done today, I did almost 50 years ago. I built all my sound equipment. Every instrument I had was had a microphone on it or a pickup from the bass on down. Yeah, it always, people always was able to hear my music. You know, it's no reason why I have such longevity because I always tried to do it right. I tried to give the public what they wanted. So when it came to the Rumble in the Jungle, Don had this idea that we should do something with fighters, because the fight game at that time was either, how could a world crown, like the world championship, be held in New York, Detroit, or California? You have to make it universal.
Right.
So at first, it was going to be here in a country, in America. The trouble was, how would it be feasible? What kind of money would these guys need? And the biggest gate at that time was when the guy that owned the L.A. basketball team, the Lakers, I'm trying to think of his name right now, did the fight with Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier at the Madison Square Garden for $5 million. They got $2.5 million apiece. Well, how do you get guys to fight overseas? And up come Don King. Don King had done a lot of local stuff in Cleveland. He had done a lot of local stuff in that whole Ohio area with fights. And we decided that it would be a universal thing. Let's take it to Europe. Couldn't get nobody to take it in Europe. Don was in Paris. He wound up meeting a guy called Manduga Bula, who was an advisor to Mobutu. And Mobutu had just changed the country from the Belgium Congo to Zaire. He needed something exciting and explosive to get the world press to come to Africa to see his new city, Kinshasa, and on and on. That's how the fight wound up down in Zaire. The Rumble in the Jungle was born when Don King met Manduga Bula on a street in Paris, thinking he was somebody he knew.
That's funny.
Isn't that funny?
Now, were you an investor, or were you in charge of the musical side of the whole event?
Well, actually, at that time, this was, I guess, the first biggest event ever in the world besides Woodstock. I was in charge of putting together the show, the filming, and the whole bit of the entertainment specter of that extravaganza. We had planned to have the biggest promotion ever in the history of the world. That was a promise Don had made to Mobutu. And he planned to pull it off by signing up everybody who was anybody. We took everybody who was in Fania Latin All-Stars. We had signed Aretha Franklin, Marvin Gaye, Stevie Wonder. We had the Spinners, who was just red hot at that time.
Oh, yeah.
Sister Sledge, who was just coming aboard, had never made a record at that time. Hugh Masekela, Miriam Makeba, all the people in Africa who were stars. We had everybody who was anybody. We had the whole Woodstock crew and camera, sounding, lighting, to come over and do the first digital filming was all done in Zaire to make the Rumble in the Jungle the biggest event that ever happened in entertainment. But what happened, 6 weeks out of the fight, George Foreman was training with one of his aspiring partners and got his eye cut. So the fight was delayed for 6 weeks. It still was the biggest event that ever happened. We transmitted the first transatlantic film and sound around the world. And the Rumble in the Jungle will go down in history as being one of the great events of all time. But it got screwed up right at the end, but it would have been one of the biggest grossing events of all time. We had booked every venue around the world. We had sold tickets to everywhere around the world. When George got his eye cut, there was no basketball, there was no hockey, there was no soccer in any of these venues around the world on September the 24th. But when we had the fight October the 31st, all the events was going on. So that's why it wound up not making the money that we thought it would make. But it still was a great event. Mm. And that was the event that put Don King on the map.
Oh, yeah.
And the Rumble in the Jungle became will be in this historic component in the books forever.
Right.
And my involvement, of course, you asked me about it. My involvement was to produce the show.
The music.
The entertainment, yes.
Yeah, okay. Which you did a great job.
Mm-hmm.
All right, it's the early 50s. It's New Orleans. Paint me a picture.
Well, my mother had a little fish fry. She had, on Thursday nights, she built this little room onto the house where she could fry fish and make potato salad and sell beer and soft drinks on the weekend. And inside of that, it was a piano, an old broken down piano and a jukebox. And we kids never had anything to do. Who was on the scene? Professor Longhair was on the scene. Smiley Lewis, Larry Donnell, Paul Gayton and Anna Laurie. Man, Big Joe Turner was hanging out in New Orleans. Ray Charles had just got there to the Dewdrop. So we were teenagers, but we could not go hear all these great people. We just heard about them. So we would try to mimic all these great artists that who was in town or living in New Orleans. In my mother's shop on that old piano, we would try to do that. Up the late part of 1951, there was a disc jockey came to town. First black, big, and he was a big guy, disc jockey, named Okie Dokie Smith. And at that time, we was listening to WLAC and from Randy's Mark in Nashville, Tennessee, Big John R. Only time we would hear rock and roll and rhythm and blues music, of course, it had no name to it at that time, was that night. And it was like coming from Mars. Hey, we barely hear it. Wynonna Harris and these people. We decided that we would put a band together ourselves, my little brother and me, and try to make that match that same music that we heard on WLAC from Nashville, Tennessee, and Okie Dokie Smith, who had just came to town. Well, here's the hook, Matt. He had one commercial, and it was Maxwell House Coffee. So he had to make up his own rhymes and everything for this Maxwell House Coffee. And the radio station didn't pay these guys. They only got paid by whatever sponsorship they brought in. So he had Lord and Miss Claudie eat mother's homemade pies and drink Maxwell House Coffee. Lord and Miss Claudie. So, one day I was listening to that. I said, whoa, I decided to go. Now, he'd on air now maybe 4 or 5 months. We're inside of 1952. And I said, well, you know what? I think I could write that. And I start banging on the piano. Lordy, 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 Miss Claudie. Girl, you. I just made a girl out of it. You know what I mean? And Dave Bartholomew, who at that time was the first black producer in New Orleans. And he had produced a record on a guy called Fats Domino and was called The Fat Man. They call me the Fat Man. Well, that I had heard that kind of melody all my life because we all played what they call an 8-bar blues. We all would stand on the corner. We could take that same melody and sing 1,000 songs to it. But Fats just happened to take it and made Fat Man because he played piano. And it was a smash, super smash. And we tried to do that. But then I was playing Fat Man when Dave Bartholomew came in. I decided to go and play Lord and Miss Claudie. So that same 8 bars, that music. And he heard me making up all these words, and I never sung the same line twice. He said, you know what? I like that. Maybe that could be a hit record. Totally, totally new terminology to me, new language. I never heard anything about a hit or record. I didn't know what that was, even though my mother had a jukebox. I used to dance to Louis Jordan. Every record that come up, Amos Milburn, Roscoe Gordon. I knew all these people by name because I always loved music. And he telling me that I could do that, I thought he was joking. So he said, you know what? Play that for me again. I played it for him again, ad-lib. Couldn't remember no words because I didn't know nothing about writing no songs and nothing like that. He said, you know what? I got a guy coming in town. I want you to play that for him. I'm going to bring him out here and I want him to hear it. The guy's name was Art Root. From Specialty Records. Sure enough, 3 weeks pass, he brings Art Root out to my mother. And I played Lord and Miss Claudie for Art Root. And Art Root used a term I never will forget. He said, oh, that could be a smash! And he had his wife with him, Lee Root, and she said, I love it, I love it, I love it. So they said, you know what, we're going to record you. Had no idea what they was talking about. He said, I got to go to Baton Rouge. I'll be up there for maybe a week or two, but when I come back through here, I want you to meet me at Cosmos. I'm going to record you. Okay. I said, okay. And that was it. 2 weeks, maybe 2.5 weeks, Dave Bartholomew calls me up. I want you to meet me at Cosmos. Come on down here right now. I get on the bus, and I goes down to North Rampart Street to Cosmos. And in that studio. It was a little studio, not half big as this. Fats Domino, Dave Bartholomew, Lee Allen, Earl Palmer, Mac Lynn, the greatest musicians, all my heroes that I had heard about. Professor Longhair was even in the studio, but he was not going to play out. I didn't know who was going to play. Fats Domino later told me he just had dropped by because he heard Dave was going to have a session. He had no business being there. But to make a long story short, Fats Domino got on the piano, and as you hear that introduction on Lord of Miss Claude, he was playing that. I said, oh, this guy could really play piano. And I'm standing in the corner. I don't know what to do. I'm just standing there. And Dave Bartholomew came in the studio. Art Roop and Lee Roop is in the booth with Cosmo. He tells me to go over and get on a microphone. So I don't know what he's talking about, a microphone. What is a microphone? So he said, over there, go stand over there in that corner. And he brought this big old mic. Mic was that big, the head on the mic. And he said, just say something. And I said, what you want me to say? And he said, just keep talking. I kept talking. And he said, okay, we got that. And go over and give Fats the key. Now, what key? What is this? What? I don't have no key. No. Go over and sing the song for him. You know what I mean? I went over and Fats still playing this introduction. So Fats says, come on, sing that thing for me. And I said, Lordy, 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 Miss Claudy. And I sung it down. He said, oh, I got it. He said, okay. So Dave said, you know what? Sing that three times. I thought he was talking about the same thing. So he said, I sung it. He said, no, you got to change it. And I said, well, I'm going to tell my mama you took my money and you stay out late at night. That was my three subject matters I was going to deal with. Then that Fats played that introduction again. Lee Allen took a solo. I sung it twice in Bye Bye Claudio Darling. Never heard it. There's no playback. Never heard it. That was the end of it. He said, do you have another side? Sing another song. Well, I was thinking about going to the Army. So Fats started playing a boogie woogie. And I just said, well, night before last, the mailman knocked on my door. He said, yeah. Well, night before last, sing. And Fats said, dude, well, I knew how to do 12 bars, you know, in lyrics. So I just kept ad-lipping. Lee Allen took another solo. End of that, never heard anything.
One take on Mailman Blues, too?
One take. That was the beginning of what they now call rock and roll.
I'm gonna tell night before the last, the mailman knock on my door. Well, night before the last, the mailman knock at my door. He said, get ready, brother, this time you have to go. Oh, mailman, mailman, tell me what you got for me. Oh, mailman, mailman, tell me what you got for me. He said, a long letter, brother, we need you across the sea. Well, now all day long is 1, 2, 3, and 4. Well, all day long is 1, 2, 3, and 4. Well, I'm so unhappy I can't see baby no more.
Lloyd Price's first record, Specialty Number 428, charted back in April of 1952, went to number one for 7 solid weeks on the Billboard R&B charts, and went on to sell millions of copies. In fact, Lloyd Price is the first teenager to sell more than 1 million copies. And man, that record was huge. And a lot of its success can be traced to the fact that it actually crossed over into the white record-buying public. In fact, Art Roop, the owner of Specialty Records, did some research on it when it got to be so huge and found that to-do white people were sending their maids and butlers out to black record stores to buy this record. That's what kind of an impact it had. And it certainly launched the career of a young Lloyd Price. Now, in Lloyd's new book, Lottie Miss Clottie, The True King of the 50s, Lloyd dedicates chapters to his remembrances of the 1950s. There's one on disc jockeys of the 50s, one on record producers of the 50s. He has one on nightclub promoters, another on nightclubs, record retail shops, record magazines. He remembers some of the greatest guitar players of the decade. Plus, he gives a lot of credit to those unsung heroes of the 1950s. To learn more about Lloyd's new book, click on the banner over at FridayNightCatFight.com. And coming up later on in the show, we're going to have a Lloyd Price Friday Night Catfight. But first, let's get back to my interview with Lloyd Price as we continue discussing Lottie Miss Clottie and Mailman Blues, his first record.
Well, wow, that was incredible.
That's how it happened, Matt. But right, what was so amazing, when the record came out, you know, weeks later, I didn't recognize who it was. I kept hearing this record, Lottie Miss Clottie, and Okie Dokie was burning it down. By time, he's now the biggest jockey around New Orleans.
And you got his catchphrase.
Yes, he's got our, and I'm just hearing Lottie Miss Clottie. I don't know who it is because I'd never heard myself.
Did you think you were ripped off? Somebody was singing your song?
I had absolutely no idea. I kept hearing, I said, that sounds like me. So my brother, I had told my brother, the only one I told, what I'd done. I went down to New Orleans and recorded this thing with Fats Domino. He said, that's got to be it. They keep saying Lloyd Price. That's you. That's who they're talking about, Lloyd Price. I didn't even know they were talking about me, and I'm hearing my name. But I never recognized, I never thought, because I never heard my voice that high pitch. I was just a kid. And I bet you 4 or 5 weeks after that, that's all you can hear around America, 24 hours a day, was Lottie Miss Clottie. Flipped it over. It was number one, number two, A and B, Mailman Blues and Lottie Miss Clottie. And the next subsequent 5 records, I Wish Your Picture Was You, right on down the line, both sides got the hitting.
It was
an amazing thing.
1952 was an unstoppable year for you.
No question. It was nobody. It was no Michael Jackson. It was no Elvis Presley. There was nobody. No Beatles, no Rolling. No. It was only Lloyd Price. And that kind of like integrated the music in this country.
And when you talk about the first rock and roll records, you know, it's always
Good Rockin' Tonight, Wynonie Harris. It's Rocket 88, Jackie Brenston, and Ike Turner. It's Lottie McLottie, Lloyd Price. It's always, you're right there with, well, what was the first rock? Well, you know, and you got that list. You know, on my show, we talk about that all the time. Well, what was the first rock and roll record? And, you know, it's I don't like to actually say, because there's no answer. They were all, you know what I mean? It was happening at the time.
That's correct.
And everything was happening. But Lottie McLottie, like you said, I mean, it was unstoppable.
It turned the world around, Matt. Even though Roscoe Garden and Ike Turner, they had a great, Rocket 88 was a big record. And Wynonie Harris was a big record. But nothing turned the world around like Lottie McLottie. That was a teenage record. They understood it. I was a kid in, where it really was big was in skating rings, because that was the skate time. Everybody wanted to roller skate during that period. You could not go in a skating ring in America where Lottie McLottie was not the song all night long. They skated to it. So that gave me a really good kind of, vision of where this music was going to go and how the kids was buying it and how they liked it. So, but I didn't hear, I heard other records there, but they didn't play no records like they played Lottie McLottie.
It's interesting how Mailman Blues was the flip side, and you're talking about going overseas, and sure enough, what, 2 years, 3 years later, you're overseas.
No, it happened before then. Actually,
when did you go over?
I went overseas, and it was about 2 years.
54.
I went over in November of 1954. And I recorded Lottie McLottie came out, say, summertime 1952. Well, I had just about rewritten a whole music book in that period of time. And I was told by my draft board that I was causing such a ruckus with my music and integrating places that should not have been integrated, with kids dancing together outside. Let me give an example, Matt. When I would go to town, they had, each town I went into, they had what they call was spectators. The white kids were spectators. And it was like, say, a black dance. There was always more spectators than it was black kids who came to see me. And that most, well, sometime it was 50%. But the white kids would always outweigh the black kids. I guess because economically they had the money to come. And so they start putting a rope in the middle of the buildings in North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, because they all wanted to be on the same floor. Back during that time, they would do the dances in armories, in the military armories they had upstairs. Well, there was never enough room for the spectators upstairs, so they had to start bringing them downstairs. So when they brought them downstairs to keep them from integrating, they had to put a rope in the middle of the floor, and the white kids would dance on one side, black kid would dance on the other side. Well, you can imagine how long that lasts. And there was never no more than one cop. And there was never no incidents. But that kind of, to me, was what we call integration. When that rope came down, these kids just started mingling. There was never no problem, never no fight, never nothing. If the cop wouldn't have been there, it was just would have been like any ordinary place in the world where people mix and respect each other as human beings. But that was the reason why I went into the service, because my music, as they said, was causing a ruckus.
Wow. I still can't believe that that's the truth, but that's amazing. That's amazing.
Yes.
During the time, I know that, well, you probably didn't even have a contract or anything with Specialty, right? Because, I mean, Roop just released the record and didn't, I mean, you obviously didn't even know it was you. You didn't even know it was coming out. So obviously you didn't sign on a dotted line, or did you?
No. What happened was, Matt, was this. You're absolutely correct. I did not have a contract. When the record hit, Art Root came down here because I was a minor. I couldn't sign a contract. He had to have my parents to sign for me.
And your parents were kind of strict, weren't they?
Yes, they were. You know, it was eight kids. Eight boys and three girls. It was 11 of us.
Wow.
So they had to be strict. I was the eighth kid, and I was probably what you call a good child. I worked with my father. I did a lot. I was working.
What was your father doing? What were you doing?
My father was, I guess what you call a jackleg plumber. He would put septic tanks and stuff in the ground.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
He would, you know, tie in drainage to the houses. He'd never done the internal work, but he always would do the outside work for the plumbers. And I was his helper. And he certainly did not want to get rid of me.
Yeah.
But when Art Rood came down and found out that I was not even 18 years old, not old enough to sign a contract, he came up with this lawyer, Charles Levy, who later became Fats Domino's manager and administrator, to take me across the river in New Orleans, we call it across the river, to a place in Gretna, Louisiana. And I was emancipated. I had my own power of attorney. My mother and father gave me power of attorney to do whatever I wanted to do with my life. I could do anything except vote. And that kind of like, I grew up. And it's kind of like part of my history of why I do and why I did all my own stuff. Because at the age of 17, I signed my own contract with Art Rood for 3%. I had the first 3% contract during that period. Art Rood, I think the record had sold maybe 50,000, and he seen it to be a big record, and he had no contract on me. And Don Robey.
He had to get you, because if he didn't have you, you could have gone someplace else and make an even bigger record,
absolutely,
right? So he had to get you under contract. So he gave you a good deal.
Yes.
To get you under contract.
Gave me three cents. He gave me three cents
on each record.
Yeah, when people was getting a penny, some wasn't getting nothing. So he gave me 3 cents a record. And Don Robey had Buffalo Booking Agency at the time, who had Gate Mouth Brown, Big Mama Thornton, Johnny Ace, and all these folk, rushed to my house to sign me to his agency, and he started thinking that I was going to be a big star. You're going to be bigger than anybody. White kids love you. Black kids love you. Everybody love you. So they kind of was hipping me, and I never drank, never smoked, still don't. I wanted to learn, and I was learning as these guys was talking to me how to do business. And from 17, I kind of like managed my own boat.
When I think of the life I live.
but I have only one life to give. Well, somewhere down the road, maybe I forgot to pray. Well, I didn't know what to say. Lord, have mercy. Myself from shame. I'm gonna change my way of living. I'm gonna deliver myself from shame. Maybe I don't have the love of a mother. Well, maybe I am not the blame.
Oh boy! Well, back at that time, and you know, it's good to hear, good to get the actual information about how the contract came about and how you emancipated yourself. That's amazing. I mean, even at that time, you were making, you know, your own important decisions for your career. I mean, you know, nobody was like leading you around. That's great. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of funny because the history I've done dug up on that time too is that Bartholomew was supposed to be, you know, he was working for Lou Chud at Imperial as the talent scout. But him and Lou had a falling out, so he started doing some moonlighting on the side for Art to kind of sock it to Lou Chud, and that's when he discovered you.
Yeah.
You could have been on Imperial if he was...
That is totally correct.
I mean, not that that would have necessarily changed a whole lot, but I'm a label guy. I really like I like the label histories, and I love... just record labels, you know?
Right.
So for me, the record label is a lot more important to me than it might be to some people, but seeing you on Specialty and trying to picture you on Imperial, too. And, I mean, it's like, you know, not that far-fetched, but of course, Dave was like you mentioned, Smiley Lewis, the Spiders were big down in New Orleans.
Yeah.
And Shirley and Lee were big.
No question. Dave was the man.
All right, so you came out of the military. It's 1956, right?
Right.
You start your own record label, KRC?
KRC.
And what that stand for?
Kent Record Corporation. Yeah. How that came about was I had written this song called Just Because, and I bought my contract back from Art Roop, bought my contract back from Don Roby's Buffalo Booking Agency, because I wanted to do my own business. I'm just a kid. I said, maybe if the record hit for Don Roby and hit for Art Roop, and hit for Luchup, it should hit for me. I had no idea what I was doing. I took an office at 913 U Street up there by Powers, right in front. It was a police station right in front. And I said, well, I'm going to do it right here. Now, Kent, Bill Boskent, was my tutor. He was my guy to finish my education with. And he was doing that when I recorded Lord and Miss Claudie. I had hired him. He was working at the Pentagon, and he'd take time off and go on the road with me so I can get all my stuff straight, you know, in my head about my education. So when I came out, we was discussing a record company. I wanted the record to be called Lloyd Price Records. So by him being my tutor, he says, you know, you got to have a short name. KRC. Mm. So I didn't like that much. So I discussed it, if you notice, on the records, Logan. Logan was the guy who remembered I was in Career. He was a promoter from West Virginia, and I had told him about my idea of having a record company back east because there were Don Robey and Dolphin of Hollywood. We know where Jesse Belvin was recording.
Oh, yeah.
I said, why don't I have a record company, you know, and do my own stuff? If I just sell around Washington, you know, I was real hot here, very popular in D.C. Maybe I'll make enough money here to just do something else. My hopes were to sign Fats Domino, sign all the New Orleans artists, you know, Professor Longhair. I certainly would have given them more than a penny, a nickel. You know, because half of it is yours. Whatever we make it together. That was my idea of a record company back during that time. But I knew, I had no idea what I was doing. And I had my cousin here, who was Larry Williams, was driving me. He was my chauffeur. Picked him up in New Orleans and brought him here. Living with me at my house when I wrote Just Because. So when I did Just Because and put the record out here, John Bandy and I forget who was in the box down at WST in Washington here, they went right on the record. Record just broke out. Swart Brothers, Maxi Waxi was started on the record. My cousin Larry Williams asked me to loan him some money to go home. He lived in California at the time in San Francisco.
Uh-oh, I smell a story here.
I said, okay. I gave him the money, and he went in straight to Art Roop. Told Art Roop he had wrote Just Because. And Art Roop recorded it. And now I can't go up against Specialty. At that time, Specialty was the biggest R&B company in the country. Atlantic, nobody was close to Specialty because they had all the gospel.
They had Little Richard.
Yeah, well, I had taken him Little Richard, you know, and just before I went. In fact, I met Little Richard before I went in the Army and told Art Roop about Little Richard. I called him from Tokyo and told him he should have Little Richard sending some tapes.
Because Little Richard was on Peacock, right, in the early 50s.
Not then. He was on the road with Johnny Otis. But when he went to Peacock, I sent him to Don Robey. Remember, that was my agent. Little Richard had jumped on my stage in Augusta, Georgia, and he was the first time I'd ever seen a man with that much hair and in a chartreuse suit. You know, I'd never seen a yellow shirt. Yeah. I had never seen nothing like that. You know, I'm a country boy. Yeah. Stopped banging on the piano, just like he does today. But it was exciting. People loved him.
Oh, yeah.
And I told this exact thing verbatim, what I'm telling you, I told Art Roop. You got to find this kid. And my little brother, Leo, you know, you'll notice on Little Richard record on Send Me Some Lovin', that's my brother Leo. I sent him the lyrics from Career. And he gave him to Little Richard, Send Me Some Lovin'. You know, but anyway, I won't.
So you wrote the song, but Leo gets the songwriting credit for that one.
Absolutely. And Leo finished it up and got Little Richard to do it.
Wow.
But what happened was when Larry Williams told Art Roop that he had wrote the song, Art Roop called me and told me, don't put the record out, you know, send him my invoices, because I'm doing his song, which was all wrong. Bill Boskin had Just Because copywritten. ABC had just came on the scene, ABC and Paramount, okay? Fred Foster, who, you know, had Monument Records, sure, at that time was their national promotion man. He came over to see me, said, listen, Art Roop's going to bury you with this record. I'm trying to do the record on my own. I don't know what I'm doing. And they offered me, listen to this, Matt. Back during that time, in 1956, offered me $25,000 advance for the record and a 10% royalty, and I keep the publishing.
Wow. It's a win-win situation for you.
Couldn't let it go.
You get national distribution.
Absolutely. And they told me, don't worry about Art Roop. They'll take care of that. And that's what happened. We outsold Art Roop. Larry Williams didn't get off, but it did build him a career. He's my first cousin.
Just because you left and said goodbye, do you think that I will sit and cry? Even if my heart should tell me so, darling, I would rather let you go. Just because you think that you're so smart, going around and breaking lovers' hearts. Before I let this thing happen to me, darling, I would rather swim the sea.
someone who's kind, with a heart as good and pure as mine. But maybe I am asking for too much. Darling, please don't ever break my heart.
So Just Because, obviously, becomes a huge hit. You're back.
Yep.
No question about that. And what happened to KRC? It just kind of faded away when you signed with Paramount?
No, actually, I only signed that one record with Paramount. I came back, and we did some other stuff. I wanted to produce other artists. My heart have always been in producing. So we came up with a couple of kids, a kid called Eddie Seacrest. When Elvis was so hot, I thought, "So here's a white kid, can be an Elvis Presley." We brought him into town, produced him, and we produced Stella Johnson, and Lil Sonny Warner was with us.
Okay.
And nothing happened. So I decided, you know, I should write a song, another song for myself and record myself again. I wrote a song called You Need Love. I thought it would be the greatest song in the world. Clyde McFadden had just came out with
Treasure of Love.
Treasure of Love, something like that. And Clyde was a great friend of mine.
Oh.
So I wrote this song, You Need Love, You Need Love. I thought that was going to be the biggest record in the world. And I decided to put a B-side on the back of it, Stagger Lee, a song I had done in Korea, you know, as a play for the officers. So I would just put Stagger Lee on the back by happenstance. And I couldn't play what they call the turnaround. You know, when you get to the end of the verse or the chorus, you got
to
have a turnaround.
To
all I could play
one.
Was those eight bars. Uh-huh. Eight bars. Those same chords in Stagger Lee I use in Lord and Miss Claudia. I use in several others. It's the same thing, just the tempo just faster. And instead of a turnaround, I just bum, 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 bum. And that was the signature song. Naturally, Stagger Lee went on to be one of my biggest, biggest songs ever. And
what was the origins of Stagger Lee?
The origins of Stagger Lee was my father. I'd heard him, my uncles, from a kid. You know, they would sing lyrics in that patois down in Louisiana. I couldn't understand what they were saying. And back in when I was a teenager in Louisiana, I think it was 1951, I heard Archibald came out with it where I understood it. And he even had him going in the cemetery and all that stuff. But he was calling it Smack-a-Lee. So I said, let me just try to make some sense out of this when I was in Korea. And I decided to call it Stagger-Lee. The night was clear. I put this top on it. This was the play. These guys would act this thing out, and the moon was yellow, the lights and all that stuff would come. The leaves would fall, paper would come down. And we would do that show for the generals. That was my B-side. And we tried to make You Need Love go for about a month and a half on ABC. I had re-signed with ABC. ABC decided that to sign me as an artist, but I couldn't do no more work with KRC. So that's what happened to KRC. I signed with ABC for 3 years. A guy from Seattle, Washington, a disc jockey, called us and said, you're on the wrong side. I never will forget. It was snowing that day. Larry Newton, the vice president and the sales manager, called me. Said, we're on the wrong side. We got to turn the record over. I was rebelling. No, You Need Love is the greatest song ever. But you can't turn it over. Just stay with it. So he called me back. I said, okay, turn it over. That afternoon, they had 200,000 orders for Stagger Lee. Unbelievable.
Just like that.
Just like that. And Stagger Lee went on. I've been hearing stuff over the years about records being number one for 3 weeks. Stagger Lee was in the top 10 for 18 weeks. It was number one maybe 13 to 14 weeks of that. Of course, we didn't have Grammys and we didn't have all the ARIs, RIAA that we have now. That came right during that period. But Stagger Lee was just an unbelievable song.
Do you ever get tired singing Stagger Lee?
Well, you know what? I quit for a while, and now it's a lot of fun. I do it now. It's just wonderful. And I understand what it is, and every time I play the record, I can hear the hit. You know, I didn't hear that then. But now I know why it hit. I hear it.
It was such a big production. I mean, you had backup singers. You had a big band on that. That's a big sound.
Well, let me tell you, Matt. Each one of my songs that I've ever had, if you listen to them, you see that they were all different. When I did Stagger Lee, I wanted to do something a little different. I wanted to use background singers because I'm a soloist. So I said to Sam Clark, who was the president at that time, I got an idea of how we should do this. I don't want what we call the black sound, you know, the doo-wops, but I want voices. But I want the voices, and it's got to be an arrangement, and he gave me Don Costa. Don Costa was the arranger, and what I played in my right hand, I told Don Costa, I want the horns to do that, you know, and I want the voices to mimic what the horns doing and just singing some of the words, like go Stagger Lee, and you hear the horns go, da-da-da-da, go Stagger, da-da-da-da, go Stagger, you know, that kind of stuff. And I did an arrangement by mouth and by what I can play by hand on piano to Don Costa, and I told him I needed a big band. That's separated me from those three horns of New Orleans, and everybody was using three horns, a baritone, a tenor, and a trumpet. I wanted three trumpets, two trombones, you know, and that kind of stuff, 12 singers to put me into another market. So whenever I put a record out, it went straight to the pop chart. I didn't have to worry about that R&B stuff.
It's kind of like you had the same concept going in your head that Ray Charles was doing over Atlantic with his Genius of Ray Charles album.
Not true. All that came after me. When Ray Charles and I was in Atlanta and I had a big band, Ray Charles was using Fathead and three or four more people. I had 14 people on the stage. We just blew them off the stage. James right. Brown, they all emulated my big band. I always had a big band. And they start mimicking what I did. When I tell you about Ray Charles, I went down to Lexington, Kentucky when I heard Ray Charles was going to be leaving Atlantic. And made the deal for Paramount Records.
You made the deal?
Yeah. Yeah. for Larry Newton with Ray Charles.
Didn't Ray get a better deal than you?
He did.
He owned his own master.
Yes, he did. But at that time, I was going to leave and form my own company, Double L.
Okay, yeah.
So I don't know if his deal was better because at that time, when I formed Double L, I had Wilson Pickett. I opened up with Wilson Pickett.
Yep. That's great. And that was Wilson Pickett after the Falcons.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He was with Bill Doggett.
If you need me.
Yeah. If you need me, exactly.
Yeah. And there's another two guys, you know, because you got Solomon Burke with the same record. And that's a whole other story, too.
I'll tell you about that. They offered me a deal on that. I'll tell you about it.
Oh, okay. You want to just.
Sure. Yeah. Well, what happened was Ahmet Erdogan called me and asked me to pull my Wilson Pickett record. And, take a back end with Solomon Burke. Well, my loyalty was to Wilson Pickett, you know, not Solomon Burke, because Solomon was a big star at that time. What I did was when I realized that I was going to get covered by Atlantic, they're red hot now, I had to find a way not to lose Wilson Pickett. So what happened was, you know, black radio was from dusk to dawn during that time. I bought nighttime radio on WWRL. I bought it forever. And hired my own disc jockey, the Magnificent Montague, to play my records on WWRL for $600 a week. I bought all that time for $600 a week. I bought from 8 o'clock at night to 2 o'clock in the morning. Not only did I do it in New York, I did it in Detroit, Birmingham, Atlanta, and New Orleans. I had all of the pop jockeys who would go off at 6 o'clock, come back on and do my time at night and play my records with Double L.
This is filling in so many blanks. I wish I had talked to you years ago, Lloyd. Wow, you hired the Magnificent Montague. Well, Pickett ended up on Atlantic.
Yes, he did. What happened was, a year in after he did It's Too Late and did an album for us, I found out that Pickett, you know, was probably the wildest man in the world. The first tour I sent him on, he shot his brother in the knee, and I said, oh, I bought him a Buick. He wanted a Cadillac. And I said, this is too, I don't know how to do this. I didn't know how to handle that kind of stuff. I didn't pick up his option.
Okay.
Montague took him to Atlantic.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's how that happened.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, back to Stagger Lee for a second. Let's talk about how you had to clean up the song for broadcast over American Bandstand on ABC TV.
Well, would you believe, Matt, Stagger Lee shot Billy? They claimed that was too hard to go on air on ABC. Well,
but Lloyd, the bullet went through Billy and broke the bartender's glass. That's pretty hardcore, man.
Well, they might have thought it broke something else. What rhymes with glass?
Yeah, there you go.
Anyway, I was, you know, I was speaking my patois at that time. Uh-huh. They probably didn't understand what because if you notice in the beginning, I said, the night was clear and the leaves was yellow. They probably thought glass was that other bit, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But Dick Clark refused to play the record because he thought I had said something else. So I had to go in and make new lyrics for that track so Dick Clark can play it on his Saturday night program. Because Dick liked me. We was real good friends. I don't know how many times I was on his show. He even put Just Because on there. At that time, he wasn't putting on ballads. It was a dance show. I went on his show with Just Because. I don't know if that was a connection with ABC or what. It was part of ABC Network at that time. But anyway, I had to go and do new lyrics for Dick Clark Dance Party show on Saturday night. And I talked about these two guys, instead of being gangsters, I made them friends, and they fell out about a girlfriend.
No gambling.
No gambling, none whatsoever. That was too hard.
You couldn't have done it. You really needed the Dick Clark support.
Well, at that time, Dick Clark was so powerful. If Dick Clark played your record on his afternoon show, was a tremendous, you're going on the charts. You own Billboard and Cashbox and Variety right away.
Mm-hmm.
If he played it on a Saturday night show, if you number 50, you're going in the top 30, a top 20. That's how strong that show was. The kids had nothing else. There was a lot of local dance parties, but nobody was like Dick Clark. You know, he was our network, and he was the man.
Mm.
And everybody watched it. And I went from that to Ed Sullivan. Of course, that was the cream of the crop. Ed Sullivan was it.
Did Sullivan let you do Stagger Lee with your lyrics?
Oh, yes. I did Personality. And what was funny back during that time, Matt, you had to have a different kind of show for that audience. It was a white audience and a black audience. I had to sing, on Ed Sullivan, I sang Time After Time. No, I sang Foggy Day and Stagger Lee. Foggy Day and Personality. I had to do two songs, and one of them had to be of a standard origin. Yes.
So they could relate.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So when you did Stagger Lee, you didn't have to change the lyrics?
No, not at all.
Which is funny because there's tons of stories about how Ed wasn't comfortable with, you know, Rolling Stones lyrics, Doors lyrics, things that came after you. But I mean, you know, it was okay with the violence and Stagger Lee.
But you know what?
Because there were no drug references or sex references.
None whatsoever. Yeah. And I don't even suspect that. Well, I never allowed drugs in the band. All my guys had to look like the Pope. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
They had to have that attitude. If they did smoke or get high, I knew nothing about it. Because why jeopardize somebody else's life and career because of your personal habit?
Right.
And I believe that today. If a guy want to get high, go get high on your own. Don't do it here. And that was kind of my reputation. And I had dinner with Ed a few times, and he and his wife. And he probably thought I was a nice guy, and he let me kind of do what I wanted. And I knew Ray Block.
Mm-hmm.
They later brought the whole Ed Sullivan show over to my nightclub. My club was just across the street from the Ed Sullivan Theater.
Oh, it was on Broadway.
And they rehearsed, yes. They rehearsed the whole Ed Sullivan show every Sunday in my club, every weekend, every Saturday and Sunday before the show went on. That show was done at my nightclub first.
Really?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Never heard that before. Wow.
Well, nobody
amazing.
Writes about Lloyd. I was too smart.
The night was clear and the moon was yellow and the leaves came tumbling down.
Domination of the Billboard pop chart. It was number one for 4 weeks and remained on the Hot 100 chart for 21 solid weeks, back in the winter of 1958 into 59. Now, if you've never heard the non-violent recut of the song that Lloyd had to do for the Dick Clark program, here's a little excerpt of that right now. Listen to how tame this is in comparison to Lloyd's original.
Try not to think about you. Oh, 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 oh.
personality. Well, probably your second biggest hit or third biggest hit.
Well, actually,
how'd that come around?
Actually, I was I had a gig in Pittsburgh, and normally, I do a lot of thinking as I drive. I love driving, and on this particular day, I got a call from Sam Clark. He said, "We got to put out another record. I think Lady Luck or something like that was out." He said, you're going to need a record. You're going to need one soon." And I had been thinking about this title, Personality, because, you know, when you shake somebody's hand, you describe their personality always first. Well, the guy got a great personality. Or she walks with one, you know, I said, mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. By the time I got to down the turnpike, the exit 6, I had the song. Because she walks with personality, talks with personality. I had to make it a chick again like I did that coffee in Lord and Miss Claudia. Had to use another woman. And I could not come up with a turnaround again. So as I was driving, I started thinking about this old spiritual, Wade in the Water. I don't know what made that connection. Wade in the water, Wade in the water, children. So I said, whoa, ran over. Try to prove my love to you. There it was.
Wow.
Never wrote a line, just ad-libbed it, and that, because it's so natural.
Yeah.
And I said, I need a big white choir to sing this. This is going to rule the world. And sure enough, Personality came out like this week. In most countries of the world, it was number one. It never made number one here in America. And the thing that kept it out was the Battle of New Orleans with Johnny Harton. 1814, we took a little trip. Personality probably was 2 or 3 for 10 to 12 weeks. Sold millions of records. Just me. Been on air now nearly 4 million times.
Oh, over and over, I tried to prove my love to you. Over and over. Cried and didn't know the reason why.
alone and whack your telephone, for you really had the blues. I don't know what love is, but this is one thing I know. Somebody's got to help me. These blues have got to go. I got the blues, for I'm feeling mighty sad. Oh, well, this looks like the end, my friend. Oh, I really got the blues.
One of the most requested songs on my show and has become one of my favorite Lloyd Price songs is Have You Ever Had the Blues?
Isn't that amazing?
That
song
just kicks, just from the opening. Bum, ba, ba, bum, bum, bum. Bum, ba, ba. You know what I mean? That just kicks. It just really does.
Well, you know what? There was a left-hand guitarist played with a guy called Gator Tail. Willis Jackson, Ruth Brown's husband.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Jennings.
Yeah.
It was a left-hand guitarist, first one I'd ever seen. He came to me one day and said, Lord, I got an idea about a song. Have you ever had the blues? You know, people always ask you, have you ever had the blues? So he and I sat down and we kind of put our heads together and came up with, have you ever had the blues? And he, bing, 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 didn't know which way to go. Bing, 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 have you ever sat alone and watched your telephone? Oh, you really had the blues.
And that's the horns are in there too. Do you still play that song?
Yes. You know what? It's not as requested now because it wasn't a bigger song. It was more of an R&B song.
It was a B-side, yeah.
Yeah.
That's probably why I like it so much because it's such an R&B song. Yeah.
Well, our demographics now is a little different.
Yeah.
So we got to kind of stick with those, you're too young,
the
I'm going to get
ones.
Married. Yeah. But that's a wonderful song.
Well, you just mentioned I'm going to get married. So, Johnny, you're so young. Yes. I like that how the white choir says is trying to give you advice, but you're so young, and you're like, I'm going to get married.
That's another song. I was down at the University of Virginia, and we was out playing basketball, and I was watching all these kids graduate. So what comes after graduation is marriage. So everybody playing basketball, I'm trying to think of how can I make this work. Graduation and school. Mm. And I remember Johnny Guitar, that cowboy movie.
Oh, okay.
And I just said, well, I'll take that and just say, you're too young. Johnny, you're too young to get married. These was all popular events, like Three Little Pigs in one of my records. I tried to get hooks that was familiar, that people had hummed and known most of their lives.
Right.
And I'd just taken right songs around.
Lord, I think you just nailed the secret of a hit record right there.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Well, I mean, look at you. You take something that people know. You put a beat behind it. It's like they already knew the song.
Absolutely.
They're humming it.
From Laudamus Claudia on. Familiarity. You know, that's the whole hook, is to make things that people are familiar with and what they know. I think it was either Bach or somebody said, if you can't do the introduction twice, don't put it in the song.
There you go.
Johnny, 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 you're too young.
But I'm gonna get married.
You're so young.
My name she'll carry.
Ooh, you're too young, Johnny, you're so smart.
But not smart enough to hide an aching heart. Burning full of love and desire.
Did you ever work with Louis Jordan?
Louis Jordan was my all-time hero. I got the chance to work with Louis, I think, just before he passed. I think it was in 1960. We was in Philadelphia. What a musician. What an entertainer. I mean, I can still see this man now today. People who didn't hear Louis Jordan, try to find some of his films now and see and watch this musician. What a technician this man was.
Absolutely. So
He is Mr. Rock and Roll as far as I'm concerned. Louis Jordan, Caledonia.
He was doing it 10, 15 years before rock and
absolutely.
Roll.
Absolutely. Early in the morning, they can't get right. I mean, just...
Beans and cornbread.
Beans and cornbread.
Call and response. That is just a fantastic one.
Oh, what a
What's
a
the night. Use of getting sober when you're only going to get drunk again?
You're only going to get drunk again. Hey, everybody, let's have some fun.
That's right.
Happy?
You only live but once, and when you're dead, you're done.
Oh, man.
Yeah, Ray Charles paid great homage to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Wynonie Harris is one of my all-time favorites. And I know Wynonie, he lived hard, he worked hard, he fast women, hard-drinking, hard-driving guy. Did you ever meet him, or do you have any stories about Wynonie, Mr. Blues Harris?
I did meet Wynonie. I met Wynonie several times. Now, stories, I don't have no real good stories, but what you just said is what I always heard about Wynonie.
He died of an ulcer, didn't he? He had bad ulcer pains towards
the
end of his life.
My understanding was he drank the fifth of Seagram 7 a day, and I guess that will burn you out. But Wynonie was...
Was he a nice guy?
Yes, to me he was. I met him a few times at a club in New York called the Baby Grand.
So you met him after you were big?
Yeah. I didn't meet him doing... No, I never met him.
So he was his career was pretty much done, and your star was...
He was right at the end of it, yes. Mm-hmm.
Was he... It's the thing that gets me about doing the research and listening to the music and really, really, you know, following these guys now that they're long gone is that I get the feeling that they weren't appreciated during the time. Like, I'm sure Wynonie, I mean, if I could have met Wynonie, you know, I would have been a real treat. But I just imagine that he probably didn't get the accolades that he deserved for his music.
Well, I think you're right, Matt. I don't think you can go back, but it's hard to even describe the times back during that time. It was this was a different place. Before you were born, this was a very difficult place. The music was played like from sun up to sundown. Sometime you only got the music between 10 and 4 o'clock in the afternoons. So most people was working at that time, so you couldn't get but so much credit. The dance halls usually was little nightclubs where you get 125, 200 people in, you got a packed house. So he didn't get the accolades and he didn't get the spread. Most of the acts back during that time didn't get what they deserved. You couldn't bring any white people. The only people you brought was people of color, and most of them couldn't integrate and stuff like that. So he didn't get the spread. There was no justice back during that time. But I look at this as pioneers. Pioneers got to start somewhere.
Yeah.
And look where we are today. You know what I mean?
That's true.
During that time, when I recorded Lord and Miss Claudia, the entire music industry was only worth about $300 million a year. Now,
billions.
Michael Jackson signs for that. I mean. Yeah.
That's true. when you were on Alan Freed's package tours back in the day, did you encounter segregation when you were going through the South?
Not so much with Alan, because I never worked the South with Alan. I worked with Dick Clark in the South. We did. When Johnny, with the Crest.
Johnny Maestro
with 16 Candles. I never forget, we was in Raleigh, North Carolina. And when they found out that Johnny was a white boy, the police wouldn't let him sing with the group. That was one. And in St. Louis had two sides to the stage, a back and a front. Same in Memphis, in auditoriums. You sang on one side to the white, the other side to the black.
So you're saying if you were a white performer, you'd come out on like the left side of the stage and you'd be singing to the white people who are sitting there?
No, I'm not saying that at all. Okay. I'm saying they would not let the black and white performers entertain at all. Not at all. But if white people came to see the show, they sat on the white side and the black sat on the black side. So you had to go back and forth across the stage and try and sing those who had that kind of facility. The ones who didn't have the facility, they didn't get in. You did a white night and a black night. So it started to get better and better as time went on. And it didn't really get good until maybe the mid-70s.
Really? That long?
Yeah. Yeah, it was rough here for a long time. Yeah. Well, in 1964 is when Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Bill. Now, that's a license, like a driver's license. It ain't great now. But it's a lot better than it was. Man. You would not be able to tell the difference. Those of us who have lived long enough to see the difference can tell the difference. But if you was not here when these things were going on, you'd think that this has been the same way forever. But it hasn't. It hasn't been this way at all. As recently, John F. Kennedy, I mean, when he got assassinated, I played the University of Maryland that same night when he got shot. I had to work the University of Maryland, and it was segregated that night. Yes, in Maryland. Wow. Yeah. So,
that's something.
So America has came a very, very long way. But when I've had the pleasure and opportunity to travel all over the world, this is still the greatest country on earth. This is a God-blessed nation. Even with the problems and things that we've had, we're about living these, but most people are not. It's still very bad, very, very, very bad in most parts of the world. Iraq, for example. I mean, I'm not a political person, but all you got to do is sit on the television.
That's true.
But in terms of music, music is the same everywhere. Well, I could play my music in Japan and India and Africa, Germany. Everybody knows the lyrics. Everybody knows the song, and everybody's happy. I think people should talk music when even at the what they call peace conferences. Bring Bo Diddley in and bring
it. Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more.
Let Fats Domino, and then maybe they'll have a better relationship. You know what I mean?
What is the price of happiness? How can I find me love? Where could I sell my heartache? And what do I pay for love? Where could I get me a good night's sleep to trade off my trouble and pain? How long does it take to realize that love is a priceless thing? Oh, you can't buy love if you're rich with diamond and gold. But heartaches will come around freely and knock on anybody's door. What is the price of happiness? How can I find me love? Where could I sell my heartaches? And what do I pay for love? You can't buy love if you're rich with diamond and gold. But heartaches will come around freely and knock on everybody's door. With diamond and gold, but heartaches will come around freely and knock on anybody's door. What is the price of happiness? How can I find me love? Where could I sell my heartache? And what do I pay for love? What do I pay for love? What do I pay for love? What do I pay for love?
Well, that brings us to your third record label, Turntable.
Yes.
And your club with the same name, Turntable.
Right.
And well, how did that come about?
Well, that was the mid-60s. I had done just about everything you can do. I thought in music business. I had been all over. I had played everywhere. I'd done so many one-nighters. I was kind of like getting tired. And the turntable was Morris Levy's Birdland, the jazz corner of the world, right at 52nd Street and Broadway. I heard that that place was going to close. Now, ironically, I probably was the only rhythm and blues or whatever you want to call me at that time, rock and roll act, ever worked Birdland because I had a big band.
Oh, okay.
Slide Hampton was my music conductor. Grover Washington was in the band, Gil Askey, Earl Van Dyke. Mm. All the great musicians was in my band. When I was down there, Oscar Goodstein, who at that time was the manager of Birdland, told me Morris Levy was going to close that place. And they said, whoa, you know, this would be a good spot for my band. I can house my band here and work whenever I feel like it. Plus, I'm on Broadway. That's how that came about. I started to pursue that immediately and wound up with the lease for 20 years, right at 52nd and Broadway, right across the street from the Ed Sullivan Theater, and renamed it to Turntable, tore everything down, made it the most modern nightclub in the history of New York. Had a recording studio in there. I had rebuilt the stage, biggest stage in New York for a nightclub, bigger than the Copa. Had lights. It was all hydraulics. It was an amazing thing.
Wow.
Sights. It was sound and lights, just gorgeous.
How long was the club open for?
4 years. What happened was Larry Spangler, who had the Merv Griffin. She was the producer of Merv Griffin television show at that time. He came down and he caught my show, and he thought that my club and myself would be an excellent television specimen, the first black artist on television.
Okay.
Could you imagine that?
Yeah.
And it was going to do it live from the turntable.
Oh.
Why the turntable is not there today? We was going to build turntables in all the southern major cities and Midwest. It was just a marvelous idea for franchising these clubs and the whole bit. I don't know what happened, but the day that I had the press conference of the television show, my picture was going to be in 1,700 Associated Papers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That night, you couldn't get in for the press conference. We just knew it was going to be a success. The next morning, the very next morning, Matt, they found my partner, Logan, with two bullets in his head. Never got off the ground, and I closed the turntable and moved to Africa. It was unbelievable what happened. It was going to be a tremendous thing. It was, I guess, during that integration period. It was during that time when things was real bad in this country. And they saw the turntable as being one of those monsters that will integrate. There was no policy. People was just people. And they saw me as being a television star, which was going to increase. Still don't know who killed Logan. But that shot the turntable in the foot, shot the turntable, shot me in the foot. And actually, my music career, because I moved to Africa. I start hearing phone calls that there's a bullet waiting for me, all that crazy stuff. And that's what happened to the turntable.
That's something.
Isn't that amazing?
How long were you in Africa for? What part did you move to?
I was all over Africa, wound up in Nigeria, and a little Victoria Island there in Lagos. And kind of liked it down there. You know, I really did. One, I guess, was out of trying to stay alive. Because the reality of killing people, I had to identify Logan in his office, and our office right on top of the club. So I said, this is real. And at that time, they was knocking people off left and right. And I didn't know where it came from or why. We were musicians.
Somebody thought you were a troublemaker somewhere.
They probably did. And in my background about being drafted in the Army and my music causing ruckus, and now I'm going to Broadway, somebody didn't like it. And they figured Logan was the brains of my operation. So let's get rid of the head, and what if we do that? The rest will follow. So that's what happened to the turntable.
That's a shame, man. I'm sorry to hear that. How long were you in Africa for? When did you come back?
I was in Africa from the mid, say, from 68 until about 83.
Wow.
Yeah. Back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. It was a wonderful thing. I learned more about doing business. I opened a little business over there. I was an import-export guy doing stuff. And it got me to understand my craft a little better.
Mm-hmm.
So when I came back, I went into the building business in the city of New York for the state. I built affordable housing around New York and Staten Island, the Bronx, I mean, and managed my publishing company up until a few years ago. And it's just been wonderful. I started to understand stuff a little better. And now I'm back doing what I love, and that's music.
Thanks for coming in. I
just want to thank you, Matt. It's wonderful.
Thank you so much, Lloyd Price, and congratulations on your new book. For more information on Lloyd Price and his icon food brands, including Lottie Miss Claudie's delicious sweet potato cookies, as well as information on the book, go to LottieMissClaudie.com or click on the Lloyd Price banner over on my website, FridayNightCatFight.com. It was such a pleasure to speak to the living legend himself, Mr. Personality, Lloyd Price. And now we've come to the portion of our program, Cats and Kittens, where two cats are going to battle it out over the same song. Lloyd is going to be one of those cats this week, and I'll tell you something. Having met him in person, I wouldn't want to rumble with him. All right, well, you know how this works. I'm going to play two versions of the same song. I want you to listen to them both in their entirety. Then go back to the website, FridayNightCatFight.com, and vote for the one you truly dig the most. Because Lloyd was on the program this week, we're going to do Lottie Miss Claudie. So let's hear Lloyd's original from 1952 again, and then we're going to follow it up with his competition, the other king of the 1950s, Elvis Aaron Presley, with his 1956 RCA rendition of Lottie Miss Claudie. Lloyd's first, then Elvis. Then vote for the one you truly dig the most on the Friday Night Catfight Show.
just as fine as you can be. Well, so bye-bye, baby.
Elvis from 1956 up against Lloyd's original from 1952, the immortal Lottie, Miss Claudia, Matt the Cat. Once again, I want to thank Lloyd Price for joining me this week on the world-famous Friday Night Cat Fight show. Go back to FridayNightCatFight.com, vote for the version of Lottie, Miss Claudia you dig the most, and then go to LottieMissClaudia.com and see what Lloyd Price has been up to. You know, he's a bowling champ. He's the only person on earth to be in both the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and the Bowling Hall of Fame. And he's got two signature bowling balls out as well. That's over at LottieMissClaudie.com. Thank you so much for joining me this week, cats and kittens. I hope you dug the show. If so, let me know. Leave a comment on FridayNightCatFight.com or drop me an email, MattTheCat@MattTheCat.com. I want to go out with a real barn burner. I mean, this song just nails it. It's a great jumpin' New Orleans tune, which Lloyd recorded back in his specialty days. And it even uses a popular New Orleans phrase. Like in New Orleans, if you want to say, how you doing, you say, where you at? So Lloyd's looking for his woman. Here's where you at, the great Lloyd Price. I'm Matt the Cat, and I'll catch you on that flip side, baby.
All over New Orleans, gotta find. looked all over New York.